The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening. Joni McGarry is the mother of a college junior and the co-founder of NoCollegeMandates.com, a coalition of more than 2,500 college stakeholders working to end college COVID-19 vaccine mandates. Her articles on the subject of college mandates have been published at the Daily Clout and the Brownstone Institute. She can be found on Twitter at Lady Spaulding 11. That's Lady Spaulding 11. Joni lives in Bloomington, Indiana, a big state university town. Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you for the first time and become acquainted, Joni McGarry. You have been evolving and organizing a kind of a protest movement against the campus vaccine mandates.
That's correct. Thanks for having me, Jim. May I call you Jim?
Yeah, sure.
Yes, we started NoVaccineMandates.com in January, and the sole purpose is to get these vaccine mandates on college campuses rolled back.
How did you get it up to operational speed? You know, creating an organization, especially one that's a political activism organization, is not easy. It's not like throwing a dinner party. What did you have to do to make it visible, to find people who were interested allies, as they say, and get her going?
Well, it all happened really quickly, actually. It started because I had a son going back to his winter term at Dartmouth, and Dartmouth had just mandated booster vaccines, booster mandates, and I just didn't want that to happen. So to find like-minded people at Dartmouth, and that was all I was looking to do. I didn't envision that this would turn into more of a national type of, you know, visibility. I went on the Facebook page of the Dartmouth parents to sort of troll for like-minded people because I knew there wouldn't be many, but I thought I would just say, I'm going to write a letter opposing booster mandates here. If anyone's interested, just direct message me. And so we had only a very few people who were interested, but it did sort of prompt this pile-on of hostility, as you can imagine, because the people in those groups generally, and also the majority of parents and students at colleges, are perfectly fine with this medical tyranny. But we did get a few people. But in that process, I realized that it's very difficult to find your people, your stakeholders that are like-minded if you're not living in the same town. So for instance, if you were in a high school community, you'd be able to find other families who are like-minded very easily. But when you're all spread out, you can't. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, maybe I can get together a group of parents from everywhere who are like-minded. And at the time, I had about 100 followers on Twitter. And so I just put a tweet out and said, I'm looking if there are any like-minded parents who want to oppose these booster mandates, just direct message me. And I tagged some accounts that had much higher visibility than mine and asked them to retweet it, which they did. And by the next morning, I had 80 messages, which really surprised me. And I used to own a business, and my tech guy just said, start a Telegram group. And so I did. I didn't know what one was really. By the end of the week, I think 200 people had joined through word of mouth because it spoke to this great need of people to find other like-minded stakeholders at their respective universities. Mm-hmm. Somebody in that group happened to have a Fox News contact. And so within a couple of weeks, we had two Fox and Friends morning spots. I did one of them. And after that one, we had like about 2,000 members join. So it lifted very, very quickly. So we do have that coalition of people in the chat group. We're not that well organized as an organization, but there is a core group of people who came together, and we've put up a website so that we can direct people toward resources they might want to use. And, you know, we've just gotten a lot of visibility through relentless trying to get on podcasts and, you know, just making our presence known throughout the nation.
You know, if you don't mind, there are a couple of kind of personal questions I'd like to ask you.
Sure.
How did this situation play out in the household? Was your son himself averse to getting the booster, or did he just want to like get it and get it over with? And did you have to persuade him? How did that all work?
Well, originally last summer, when the vaccines were mandated to be on campus in the fall, he told us, his father and I, because we wished he wouldn't get it. But at the time, we didn't realize there were things we could do to get him exempted from getting it. And he said he wanted to go on. He wanted to have a normal life. And so, you know, he's of age and we respect his choices. And he went ahead and got it. When the booster mandate came up, I just told him that there was no way he was getting it, and whatever he needed to do to get an exemption, we were going to do that. But he would have been fine getting it. He's not as concerned about it as we are, although he doesn't have an issue with the work I'm doing or what our views on it are.
Uh-huh.
That's not the case throughout our whole family. There has been some division there for sure. He's fine with the work I do. He's just not active in it at all.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any friends or relations who had trouble with any of the vaccines, adverse reactions or anything, or anyone you know in, you know, around in town?
In town, I don't, because I'm not really much in the town these days. But I can tell you that it's hard to know whether I'm in the bubble that gets fed all this information, but I don't think that's all of it. Because of all the networking that in the networks I'm in, I know of a lot of people who have vaccine injuries, either, you know, neurological problems or severe menstrual disruptions. One of my very good friends, her first year student son at UC Irvine, when he got the Pfizer injections, he got myocarditis right after it. And it is definitely myocarditis from the vaccine because the CDC is, in fact, following him. That also raises a point, which, you know, I want to touch on later, is that was sort of in that window where, you know, the FDA and Pfizer knew that this stuff was causing myocarditis in teenagers, and yet they were pushing for the approval for young people. You know, it brings up the issue of informed consent and whether these products should be, you know, especially should be mandated, which I think, of course, not on young people. So I do know that, you know, some people in that circle, I have had at least one family member have severe menstrual disruptions in, you know, more of a distant family. You know, I believe that's the result of, you know, the vaccines as well, because it was just on the heels of it.
Hmm. Well, these vaccine mandates appear to be at odds with certain realities of the day, namely that the vaccines don't prevent infection and don't prevent transmission of the disease, which means they're not really vaccines, and they produce large numbers of adverse reactions, that is, large numbers of adverse reactions compared to all previous vaccines.
That's correct.
I think the original SARS that broke out in the early 2000s, they attempted to create some kind of a vaccine. When 50 people had bad reactions, they just stopped it dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty weird. So those realities are pretty daunting. They in particular produce adverse reactions in young men.
Yes.
Myocarditis and other heart problems. How is it possible that eminent university people, deans and presidents, et cetera, don't understand these realities?
Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question. You know, just to jump on what you've said a little bit, the myocarditis rate in young men is much higher as a result of a vaccine than it is as a result of infection in those age groups, right? So I think it's men under 30 or 40, you have a higher chance of getting heart damage from the vaccine versus from illness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and just to explain for some people who may not know, because some people have not yet heard the word myocarditis, which totally bowls me over in this day and age, but it's inflammation of the heart muscle. And it's often brushed aside as being, you know, by the CDC or the talking, you know, heads in the public health organizations as being mild or temporary or easily treatable. But it's a heart condition. And in many, many people, it will have long-term and life-shortening effects. So it's nothing minor at all.
As I understand it, it's a matter of once your heart muscle is scarred by myocarditis, mm-hmm. the scarring doesn't go away.
That's
and
correct.
The heart tissue that has been scarred doesn't regenerate, unlike other organs in your body.
That's correct.
That can replace cells.
It's not just that, too. It's also blood clotting issues. I mean, you know, there was a student at Boston College who had a pulmonary embolism, and he had a stroke, right?
Oh, my goodness.
He stroked, and Boston College didn't break stride. We know of, you know, we hear all the time of deaths. There are so many students who are dying from a medical emergency or in their sleep or unexpectedly. And maybe they have nothing to do with the vaccine. And maybe we're just seeing more of them because of the network we're in. But I don't think so. I think that there's an alarming number of young people who are mysteriously and suddenly dying. And not to mention the suicides that are happening in this age group because the campus measures have been so draconian. It's really of concern. But your question, I think, was how are these institutes of higher education, these bastions of inquiry, how do they not know about this? And that's really the major question. When we first set about to oppose the booster mandates, and now I think they all have to go, not just the boosters, of course, but we wrote this letter to Dartmouth. And it had 40 pages of supporting documents. It had, you know, solid data. It was a well-written letter. And basically what it was saying was, here are the risks. Here are, like and like all colleges, they say these mandates are necessary basically for two reasons. One, number one, we have to prevent campus spread and protect the vulnerable. And number two, we have to protect the student. And neither of those two arguments is at all supportable by data right now, right? It's just like what you said. We know they don't prevent transmission. We have known this since the middle of last summer. And indeed, that metric was never even trialed in the clinical trial. So where the talking point of you won't catch or spread the disease came from, it feels to me like it was just pulled out of thin air. It was never in the data. But anyway, we've known since last summer that they don't prevent community spread. So that argument falls. And the argument that the student must be protected, this is a population that has a near zero risk of serious illness from death or, you know, from infection of death or hospitalization. You know, the otherwise healthy student does not, you know, arguably does not need this medical intervention. So they should be able to choose. And so we asked Dartmouth, we presented them with all this, and then we invited them to provide us with the risk-benefit analysis that they had themselves done to support their basically a practice of medicine on their students and a requirement that these students take this medicine in order to remain matriculated. We did get a response from Dartmouth, and that is not typical of other universities. Most colleges, you know, because I know a lot of people now across the country who are in this battle, most colleges don't respond at all.
So you've heard a lot of stories.
A lot of stories. So, like, for instance, Boston College, one of the worst. They had thousands of people sign a petition to the university or to the college, no response. Parents have, you know, written, no response. So there are many colleges that just don't give you the dignity of a reply. Dartmouth has been better than most, I will say. And we did get a letter back. But basically what they do is they double down on CDC talking points. So, you know, at first I thought, boy, they're really hiding behind this. But what I really have come to think, as do some other people, is that they just aren't bothering. And they are just taking their direction from the CDC websites, from the guidances issued by CDC and organizations like the American College Health Association that are all very, very vaccine forward and safe and effective, prevents community spread, protects the student. And they don't cite any data. They just double down on those talking points. So I call it a practice of medicine by platitude. It's wholly unacceptable, but it's a real stone wall that we can't get beyond. We can't seem to find the point in to get a conversation going to shake them up about the data.
Yeah, there's no lever that you can use to move these administrators and officers of the college to do the decent thing and engage.
Well, it doesn't seem so. And so we're trying a couple of different things. And I'm also investigating a lot of the money flow to colleges and trying to figure out, like, what keeps them in this bubble of either not knowing and not investigating or not caring, right? So what I've done is looked at the money flow. So if you look at what colleges get from the federal government in a year, I took the Ivy Leagues as just an example because I don't have time, you know, or the resources to do all the research. But I took the eight colleges of the Ivy League and I thought, let's look at how much federal money they get every year from the government. And the total for, across those eight colleges is a staggering like $3.4 or $3.8 billion a year. Yeah. And they are all private institutions. And like 62% of that money is NIH funding, right? And mm-hmm. they are not a disinterested party in the subject of vaccination. And further, they also got a lot of higher education emergency relief fund from the Department of Education this year. So, you know, it'd be a hard task for a college to buck that, you know, buck those guidances.
Yeah, we're going to return to this mm-hmm. particular question of the money. Our newest sponsor is Sage Restoration, a fine company specializing in high-quality traditional paints and materials for building preservation. They'd like to reach all you listeners out there living in the long emergency who are ready to start building a world made by hand. And by the way, they sent me some complimentary refined linseed oil, one of their products. I happen to be a painter myself, an art painter, and I cooked up a batch of my usual painting medium with their product, and boy, was I pleased with that. And now a few words from our sponsor. Peeling paint and rotten wood are modern problems brought on by modern plastic materials. But our building history tells us that it doesn't have to be that way. Craftsmen from the past use natural oil paints and resins to protect wood from the inside out rather than the plastic coatings of today that trap moisture and leave us with a rotten, peeling mess. As specialists in traditional wood preservation, Sage Restoration offers a whole new generation of linseed oil finishes for preserving wood and metal that lasts for decades, that do not peel, and that are easy to maintain. At Sage Restoration, it is our mission to restore our connection to traditional materials that have been proven over time and work to return the built environment to one that is worth caring about. For more information, visit their website at sagerestoration.com. That's one word, sagerestoration.com. Sage Restoration also sponsors the Eyesore of the Month feature on the Kunstler.com website. We thought that would be a refreshing counterpoint to the typical eyesore buildings we present each month. I'm wondering, though, how has the booster melodrama played out with your son at Dartmouth?
Oh, for him personally?
Yeah. You know, what did you have to go through? Has it resolved, et cetera?
Dartmouth has been actually quite cooperative with issuing exemptions. I know that on the side of religious exemptions, they have taken students at their word if a student does not wish to have a booster, even if they've had the primary series. So I think they've been very fair in that regard, although the mandate is completely unacceptable and not fair. But for exemptions, they've been pretty good. And he's also heading to an internship in New York City for the summer, where I thought they would definitely require, they were requiring boosters of all employees, no exemptions, and twice weekly testing.
Oh, gosh. But
they've walked that back, and now they are accepting previous infection and the primary series, which my son has. So, you know, for me, I'm just trying to buy him time because the repeated dosing of these things, you know, there's absolutely no long-term safety of what that's going to do to the immune system. And there are some real concerns about that.
Yeah. In fact, it looks as though the more vaxes and boosters you get, the more your immune system is compromised.
Yeah, it seems to me that the only people I know getting COVID are people who have been repeatedly jabbed.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, that's not a scientific sample. But you asked how the booster melodrama played out. I can tell you that at many colleges across the country, it's not playing out well at all. And particularly, and this is very odd, for a religious exemption, it's the religious universities who aren't taking them.
Hmm.
So for instance, Boston College and Yeshiva, they don't take them by and large for their students. They have taken them on previous vaccines, but for the COVID vaccine, they won't do it.
And Boston College is a Catholic college and
it's a Jesuit.
Brandeis is a Hebrew college.
Yep, it's a Jesuit university. You know, you look at they're granting a honorary degree at their graduation to one of the legal counsels for Pfizer. There's so much connection between these universities and the federal government and the public health institutions and the pharmaceutical industries. Like you can't definitely point directly and say this is proof that they're, you know, getting dollars for vaccines. But there's so much insidious connection that, you know, it does beg the question of institutional capture, for sure.
Oh, for sure.
So I think a lot of people have not been able to get exemptions when they wish to have them. And then also medical exemptions are very, very difficult to get. And that's for two reasons. Some of the universities will just reject them, even though your physician has written it for you. They will say, no, it's not a good enough reason, and they will override your personal physician. Or doctors won't write them because they're under increasing pressure from medical boards, from local, you know, institutions to not promote this at all, to not, you know, treat their patient if it goes against the COVID narrative. So there's so many things of concern in there.
Well, Joni, by the way, where do the HIPAA laws fit in here? Because technically, no other persons or institutions really have a right to know anything about your medical history. And I mean, does that work play in at all? Have you raised that issue with any of these people?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I think for some reason during this, quote, emergency, all of that has just gone out the window. And I'm glad you raised the question because in some colleges, you can't really have privacy about your vaccine choice. So, for instance, if you're, say, at Dartmouth, the masking policies are the same for vaccinated and unvaccinated, and the testing policies are different. But that's sort of private. You just have to test twice a week if you're exempted and once a week if you're not exempted. But at some schools, for instance, like Boston College and Peabody, which is a conservatory at Johns Hopkins, the masking rules are different for vaccinated and non-vaccinated students. So you're wearing your medical privacy on your face, number one. And then also, it's often embedded into your ID card. So there's this whole other question of electronic surveillance and your biometrics being in that system. And so when you swipe into a place with your card, it'll immediately alert the person you're swiping into that you should be wearing a mask. And often those are other students sometimes.
Yeah.
So it's a very, it's a terrible position for these kids to be in.
How did your son make out? Did he get an exemption?
He's doing fine, yes.
How has the whole medical tyranny thing been for him for what, a couple of years on campus? Has he been there in college for the whole COVID thing?
Yes, it started the spring of his first year, and Dartmouth, like many other campuses, shut down completely and went 100% to remote learning,
sure.
You know, when we all thought everyone was going to drop dead of this. And then he had a couple of terms that he was not allowed back on campus because they didn't take everybody. And then he had a term or two where they were really locked down at school, which was horrible. One term I know, they threw a bunch of kids off campus for not social distancing out of doors. I mean, just think about that. I mean, it's crazy. But now, you know, they've lifted all mask mandates and testing mandates, surveillance testing, and, you know, things are pretty normal for now. But all of those things are in place at the drop of a hat to put back in. In fact, there are several colleges that have now put their mask mandates back in place.
Well, perhaps an impudent question from me, but, you know, Dartmouth is an Ivy League college and pretty pricey. How do you feel about having to, you know, pay the cost of his education when he's not even on the campus or, you know, or if he's being pushed around and, you know, kind of mistreated?
I think I've just accepted it as a sunk cost, which is kind of pathetic. But there are people who are very upset. You know, this was something that was very important to him. And, you know, his mental health hasn't been crushed by it. And he actually did quite well on Zoom. So for us personally, and I'm not excusing it, don't get me wrong, but it hasn't been, you know, a thorn in my side so much. But a lot of other people are trying to get tuition reimbursement. And I think some of that is allowed under the Higher Education Emergency Relief Funds that the federal government spent $79 billion to dole out to colleges for purposes like this, you know, which is, you know, we could go on about that too.
Dartmouth famously has an excellent medical school. Did you engage with any of the doctors or professors at the medical school about the insanity of the vax mandates?
Yes, I didn't personally, but I have somebody who's been working with me in co-founding this and has been on the ground floor all along, Lucia Sinatra, and her son is also at Dartmouth. He's a first year, and she visited and made an appointment with one of the pretty I guess, prestigious surgeons at the Geisel Medical School. That's Dartmouth Medical School. Mm-hmm. And she thought, based on some of the things he had said, that he would be an ally. But he basically said, you know, children are dying. And she said, they're not. Show me the data. But he said, well, you have not seen what I've seen. But it's the same mindset of they're not really, I think physicians are not really looking at the data. They're just going.
Mine wasn't. I went in for a routine physical in October, and he importuned me to get the vaccine. Mm. And I said, I'm not going to get the vaccine. I'm not going to have spike proteins roving around in my vascular system. And he said, Jim, I'm 100% confident in the vaccine. And I said, have you seen the VAERS reports? And he said, well, they're not accurate. We don't think that they're meaningful.
I don't even know what to say to that.
Well,
we
I
don't
didn't
think
either.
They're meaningful. I mean, okay, let's just say, you know, it's widely thought that they're underreported, but let's just say they're overreported by 50%. Even then, it would be a startling signal. I mean, it's supposed to give you a safety signal.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's going to take. I think, you know, my husband and I have talked a lot about this because he's a physician, and we just feel like it's the academic physicians who have really let down on this, because the day-to-day physicians are just taking their walking orders from either the hospital system or the AMA, and they're not actually trained to be, you know, inquiring scientists, for right or wrong.
They're kind of highfalutin technicians.
I don't want to say that because, you know, I'm married to one, but yes.
Okay. Sorry.
No, I'm kidding. I don't think doctors are aware of this, and shame on them.
Yeah, but the ones in the universities, the guys who are the research guys and even the administrative doctors, don't they have any curiosity?
And I don't think they do. I don't think they do. And we're just trying. We're trying to figure out, you know, where does the pressure come from to mandate at each college, right? So it's different depending on what the governance is. Is it ignorance? Is it willful negligence? I don't know if you've seen any of the Ed Dowd videos.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, so actually I spoke to him last night, and I was inviting him to help me brainstorm about, could we use this angle at colleges? And he said, well, maybe if they were aware that, you know, there's some fraud coming down the road, it might make them pivot. Because right now they're totally immune from any lawsuits under the PREP Act, right? Because they're part of the COVID mitigation action. So they don't have any liability. Unless they knew and they did nothing.
Yeah, that's, you know, according to Ed Dowd, that's the whole hinge of the story right now is that fraud vitiates any liability shields.
Right, right. So, you know, here's hoping that that will happen. And until then, what we try to do is provide a space for parents and stakeholders and some professors. There are very few that are, you know, speaking up against this. I think, you know, a guy at Boston College, Peter Ireland, and of course, Dave Collum. But we try to provide a space for people who are trying to navigate this at different universities and to connect and have resources. And then on the bigger level, we're looking at, can we do legislation? Can we identify lawsuits? You know, are there things we can do to move this along more quickly? Because on its face, the science doesn't make any sense at all. None.
No, it's completely absurd.
Yeah, and it's very injurious to this group of people. I mean, the Pfizer documents came out. Most people aren't even aware that this dump came out. And if you look at, you know, when they were doing the trials for young people, they come explicitly and they say, you know, we don't know what the effect is on sperm, fetuses, pregnancy, or lactation. This is the reproductive sweet spot here for this age group. Mm-hmm. And we're coercing them to have these vaccines.
Mm-hmm. You live in a university town in Bloomington, Indiana.
I do.
And that's a big state college. That's one of those big land-grant universities.
Yes. We are a college town, and IU is the company. We're a company town, for sure.
Is there any chatter around the town about kids having adverse reactions, students having adverse reactions?
You know, I'm not hearing it here, but again, I'm not really much in the town. No, I'm not plugged in. And now that my husband isn't working for the hospital system, and the kind of work he doesn't see that much of it.
Was he working for the hospital system?
Mm-hmm. He was in private practice, and his private practice covered, he's a radiologist, and it covered like four or five of the IU system hospitals. And last fall, was it? Maybe last summer, the whole system mandated vaccination for everyone in the system, whether you worked in person or whether you didn't. Because when this whole all started, a lot of the radiologists were set up to work at home mm-hmm. just to protect them from infection. And you can do most of the work remotely.
Sure.
But IU didn't grant teleradiology exemptions. So even if you never saw a patient, you know, you could not touch a hospital case on the system.
What's it been like living in a woked up university town for the last few years?
It's been increasingly disheartening to me. You know, the politics here are so emphatically to the left, and I find it harder to find common ground with people I used to have common ground with. And partly that's because, you know, I've changed watching the, you know, the steady slide toward tyranny. And I've seen, you know, bullying of people here based on what I think are just legitimate beliefs and should be left alone. You know, so it's, you know, I don't care much for it, honestly. And what was interesting, you know, I don't do a lot of work on Facebook, but one night I just posted a snarky comment about the CDC. I said, you know, if they really care about public health, you know, do you remember when they promoted vitamin D and losing weight? And I said, I bet you don't remember, but I'm just going to follow the money. And that's all I said. And one of the professors from IU in informatics accused me of conspiracy theory. and then he went on to school me on how the CDC, in fact, did that. They did it via NPR and on their website. And I just said, the great unwashed out there they've never heard of NPR. They don't go to the CDC website. You know, it's this bubble of thinking that everyone is like them mm-hmm. is mind blowing to mm-hmm. me. Something.
Hmm. Well, let's move along a little to another area. We've got the Department of Health and Human Services, which mm-hmm. is the cabinet level umbrella for all of these other public health agencies that have been so troublesome mm-hmm. and apparently so corrupt. One of them is the National Institute for Health, institutes, plural, for health, I guess, mm-hmm. NIH. They're in a situation in recent times where all of a sudden they've become the joint holders and owners of the same patents owned by the Moderna vaccine company.
I'm nodding my head emphatically with you there.
All right. Meaning that they collect a royalty payment on every shot that is given.
Right.
You know, which in the volumes that they're selling it at worldwide is just an astronomical figure. Do you have any insight into how a federal agency gets into a position to make money out of something they're supposed to be regulating?
Well, I don't have any expertise in this area, but I will say that over the years, the coziness of regulatory bodies and the industries they regulate has just become, you know, more and more so. I worked in the pharmaceutical industry for a while when the establishment of user fees was put into place at the FDA. So you have at the FDA, and I know you asked about the NIH, but I think it's similar. Right mm-hmm. now, they're funded maybe 40% to 50% by pharma money in the mm-hmm. form of user fees. So you're not going to really regulate the person who's paying your light bill, right? You're not going to do that. And I think the NIH has all sorts of grant money that they give to startup companies, to colleges, and all this joint research. And my guess is that these patents arise from these cozy work, you know, situations. If you want money from the federal government, maybe you give up some rights. But again, I'm not an expert on that. But I think that there definitely is institutional capture back and forth from that.
Mm-hmm. These agencies make grants totaling hundreds of millions of dollars, perhaps billions of dollars. The employees of these colleges seem to be hostage to this flow of money.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said before, you know, the UC system gets about $4 billion. The Ivy League gets $3 billion. Those are just 18 colleges. And grants are given, you know, I've heard Brett Weinstein talk a lot about this, and I think it's true. I think that you're not going to get grants unless you're studying something that's anointed that goes along with, quote, the narrative, whether that ever that is. So you're self-selecting for people doing research that, you know, the authorities want you to do. You're just going to be, I think, a little obsequious to get that money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just curious. This is kind of an off-the-wall question, but do you have any kind of overarching big-picture idea or theory or story of your own about what the whole COVID-19 thing's been about?
Oh, yeah. I do.
It's painful.
I do. I just want to think about how to phrase this. I personally think it didn't jump from some animal into a human. I know that's a controversial discussion. I think it was produced by gain of function. Now, whether it was put out on purpose or it leaked, either way, I think that it was pounced upon by people just waiting to roll out universal vaccination and to test the public to see how far they would comply. And the sad thing is we've told them what we're willing to do when we're made afraid. So I think that it's being used to study behavior. I think it's being used to restrict movement, to get electronic, surveillance into place. I think it's nefarious stuff, because if you look at the actual virus, it's really not that deadly. I'm not saying it doesn't kill people. I'm not saying it isn't a real thing. But I think it's been really leveraged to get control of many aspects of our life.
For the main part, you have to be pretty sick to begin with to really get into trouble mm-hmm. with this disease.
Right, but they didn't want you to know that. And even to this day, because I was looking over what's called the White House College Vaccine Challenge, right?
It's a program. I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah. And I was looking through their different talking points and materials. And there's one where they help teens play a role in promoting vaccination. And they say, get yourself vaccinated. You're still at risk of both getting severely ill and spreading COVID to friends if you're unvaccinated. Well, it's just not true.
It's a lie.
So I think there's been a concerted effort to make this scarier than it is. I think that early treatments have been suppressed. And as far as the control stuff, I see college campuses as a perfect place to really play all this out, because it's a captive population. They're young, impressionable people, even though they're supposed to be adults, they're really not. And they'll do anything to comply. And at some schools, they have electronic surveillance, things that you have to do every single day to move about campus. There's one called the Trojan Check, which is an unfortunate name, at USC. And then there's ZotPass at UC Irvine. So I think this is the testing.
Is that like a you have to punch a key or something at some part of campus, or hold your smartphone up to a code reader or something?
I think that this ZotPass is in your phone, and I think that you have to answer a number of questions every day about your health and about your vaccination status and about your exposure to other people who may or may not have COVID. And once you answer all those questions, then you may pass about the campus for the day.
Yeah.
Does
it disturb you that no people in authority are held accountable for any of this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's so disheartening to know that any kid, that nobody's going to be held accountable for this. And if they are, I'll be shocked, because they don't ever seem to be held accountable. I mean, you look at the litany of crimes that the pharmaceutical industry has committed, and, they just get a slap on the wrist and pay a small fine for them. And at the college level, this is these are institutions practicing bad medicine, coercing their kids into getting what are EUA drugs, and either directly or indirectly lying to these kids, saying, the talking points that they're FDA approved. They're not. These are still under experimental authorization for liability shield, and the colleges have full liability if any of the students get killed or injured by this.
Have you tried to communicate directly with any officers at the various agencies under Health and Human Services, any of the public health officials?
No, I haven't. I haven't been at this that long on it. It's my work is just at the college level. I've sort of picked a lane, because I feel like we just all have to pick a lane and just chip away at it.
Well, one thing we can say is that mandates are being defeated in one area of American life after another, mostly by court decisions, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And why do you think colleges are some of the last holdouts?
Well, I think it's a couple of reasons. There was a lawsuit brought against Indiana University, and they lost, and the appeal lost too. It was not taken up, and that was disappointing.
What was it?
To get rid of the mandates. And they didn't succeed. Although Indiana University is an interesting case, because Holcomb, who's the governor here, prohibited vaccine passports or requiring proof of vaccination if you're a state agency or a university. So IU can't ask for proof, but they have to ask for an attestation that you've been vaccinated.
And is there some distinction between those two things?
Well, it's the honor code, basically. It's the honor code. But in terms of why haven't there been, you know, lawsuits, I think, first of all, it's hard to find lawyers that will take the case. And it's also very hard because you need a plaintiff. You need somebody who has standing. Mm-hmm. And that typically has to be a student. People are, first of all, there are not that many people who are bothered by this. You know, there are lots of us, but there are many, many more who are just fine. I mean, I've had parents tell me, why are you doing this? We just, you know, if the kids have to take a booster every 6 months to be, quote, back to normal, that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't see this as a problem. And I think lawyers are reluctant to take cases because they're afraid to lose and set bad precedent. You know, I know there was an injury case that this law firm recently was going to take up, and it seemed all good to go. And then he said, you know, I don't think we can win it. And he backed out. And then there's a wrongful death. There's a kid in the SUNY system, a young man who went to a community college who got the Pfizer vaccine and died. And so I'm hoping that something will come of that. But there are a lot of deaths. I mean, it's.
You heard from your members?
Well, today I heard of two deaths. One was from last week. A kid at Utica College died. And then another from, I think, somewhere in Austin. There were two strange deaths at Cornell this term, both in their sleep unexpectedly. You know, there are many of them. And I was thinking of that going on to this podcast. And here's what's really sad. I couldn't keep all of them straight in my head. Right. So you think in a normal year, if you heard of a couple student deaths, you'd remember where were they? Who were they? I can't keep them straight. And I can't say that they're all from the vaccine, but isn't it odd to you that there are so many people dying that are young unexpectedly of cardiac issues?
Sure.
Yeah. And the gaslighting is unbelievable. But you had asked me about the White House vaccine challenge, and I just want to touch on this.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think it was like $3.8 billion.
For that, maybe. I have to look up the funding. And the colleges actually don't get direct money for participation, but they sure do get a great pat on the back. And it's run by the White House and the Department of Education. And the whole goal is to get as many shots in arms as possible. And they ask the campuses to set up vaccine clinics, and they give them all these tools to promote these products as safe and effective. And then they advise the colleges to employ your coaches and your faculty to talk about the safety of these vaccines. And I think about the role of a coach to a young person. It's sort of a sacred role, right? You trust this person. They're supposed to be looking out for your physical best interests, and you're asking them to practice medicine on you. It's just, it's so unethical and wrong.
Yeah. For a lot of people, a coach is somewhere north of a parent and south of God.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and I've heard direct stories of people's kids being coerced by their coaches to not get exemptions.
Oh, boy. Hey, everybody. The Vaulted program is backed by our longtime advertiser, the McIlvany Financial Group, which owns ICA, one of the largest and longest continuously operating full-service gold brokerage firms in the United States. In times of high inflation, you might be looking to put your money into real assets, something like gold, perhaps, which has proven itself throughout history as a reliable way to protect and grow your savings during periods of market uncertainty. And you may have heard that the best way to invest in gold is to actually buy physical gold. Well, Vaulted is the mobile platform and app that allows investors to purchase physical gold. The gold is real, and it's stored at the Royal Canadian Mint. You can also take physical delivery right to your home if you'd like. It takes less than 1 minute to set up an account. Vaulted offers the lowest transaction fees and features the best cost structure in the industry. You can buy and sell your gold at any point, and there's even an automatic savings program called Vault Plan that investors can set up to automatically purchase gold every month. Buying or selling gold is as easy as buying a stock. There is no minimum investment either. You'll even get a personal advisor to speak with at any time if you have any questions about the gold markets. Learn more today by clicking the link in my show notes or by visiting kunstler.com/vaulted. That's kunstler.com/vaulted. And now, back to the podcast. Well, there are plenty of reasons to be concerned about higher education in the U.S., and the system's taken a hard turn in the last decade or more, really ever since the college loan program got ramped up and the federal government decided to guarantee the loans. The system has turned to various kinds of racketeering.
I agree completely.
One racket, of course, is the loan racket itself, which has many consequences. Some of them are very, very strange, like the tremendous rise in the cost of tuition as the college loan program got ramped up more and more. But another one is there's kind of racketeering going on. It's intellectual racketeering in the creation of fallacious fields of study. To a certain extent, really amount to just to hustles. You know, they're like race and gender hustles. And just to be clear, racketeering has a specific meaning. It means, making money dishonestly. And a hustle is a street version of a racket. So it's just, making money dishonestly, but at the nitty gritty street level. And that it seems to me to be what they're involved with. And it also seems that it's absolutely destroying the value of higher education.
I would agree. I mean, I used to really believe in the value of a college degree and, especially if you can get access to the elite universities, it would really be something. But I have to say, I'm happy for my son. He's doing what he wants to do. If he had chosen not to go to college, that would have been just fine with me. And I could never have imagined saying that 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But I don't know what's it going to take for people to walk away. I mean, even with this mandate thing, people are saying, well, the kids can just walk away. But at most colleges, there's somebody ready to fill that seat if it's an elite school. Mm-hmm. And many of these students, all of these mandates came down after they put their money down, after they paid their tuition, after they got their loans, after they got their scholarships. So they're kind of trapped.
Go on.
Just back to what you said about the crazy majors that are happening. I saw somebody tweet the other day that when you can't get a job after you get a degree in gender studies, that just shows the failure of capitalism. They were serious.
Yeah, well, just about every utterance that's coming out of that sector these days is idiotic, absurd, unbelievable.
Yes.
And then there's the news media. Of course, they're solidly behind every form of vaccine coercion.
They won't cover this.
Yeah, they won't cover it. But at the same time, every commercial in the evening news is a pharmaceutical commercial.
And all day long, by the way. Oh. When I go visit my mom, I'm amazed.
Yeah. Well, see, I haven't seen daytime TV in probably 64 years.
It's okay. You're not missing
anything. Since I went home from school with a headache or something. Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize winning economist and New York Times columnist, said the other day it wasn't the other day. He said it in the fall that going unvaccinated hurts other people.
How is this even a talking point?
Yeah, how is it even a talking point? We know that the people who are vaccinated transmit the disease as easily, if not more easily, than people who are not vaccinated.
Yeah, and that brings me to another point about housing discrimination. UConn is not allowing campus housing to those who are not boosted.
Oh.
And they also say that it's because, you're more dangerous than, they don't say this exactly, but they spread it more than people who are vaccinated.
Do they allow you to live off campus?
Yeah, but they won't, they're canceling housing for people who have, unless they have a medical exemption. If you have a medical exemption, you can live on campus in housing. But if you have a non-medical exemption, whatever that is, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. In as much as you told me that you were in communication with Ed Dowd, who emerged into the arena of the public discussion of COVID about 6 weeks ago. Nobody ever heard of him before. Right. He was a retired Wall Street guy who, it appears, he made quite a bit of dough on Wall Street and dropped out and lives in Hawaii. And he's been following the COVID story with a business partner who is an insurance company actuary. Mm-hmm. And an actuary, for those who don't know it, is somebody who compiles statistics about deaths and injuries for the insurance companies so that they can figure out a way to jiggle the odds so that they can make a profit at the insurance business, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ed Dowd has discovered something like a 40% increase in all causes deaths in the demographic of people 18 to 60 years of age, which are people in the prime of their working life.
Mm-hmm.
What's come out of your conversations with him about this? And do you have any idea of what the expectations are about how these statistics are going to look, you know, 2, 3, 6 months from now?
I wouldn't know how to predict what the statistics will look like. And I spoke to him once, and our conversation was really around how can we use your angle in a letter to colleges to shake them up. I think, you know, everything he said to me is what you have heard as well, is that they're seeing a spike in excess mortality in the younger age groups that can't be explained by COVID, that can't be explained away by, you know, mass suicides or mass drug overdoses, although that's certainly part of the picture. And I think that they're trying to drill down on that data more to, you know, find out what the coding was, you know, the WHO coding was for the deaths.
Uh-huh.
He seems to be very, very confident that by Q1, or excuse me, like that we're at the point where we're sort of at peak insanity, which is what he said when he was talking to Naomi Wolf the other night on an interview. Mm-hmm. So I'm not like sharing anything that isn't in the public domain, but he's very confident that we're at the peak of the insanity and that this stuff is going to start being noticed by Wall Street and the insurance industry. And, you know, there will be just too many bodies to cover. But there are many who think that, you know, there's so many powerful forces afoot that it's not going to happen. I mean, RFK Jr. interviewed him and sort of pressed against that and said that, you know, I don't think he's as optimistic. I don't know. I think he just felt that if you could wake the universities up to the fact that there may be fraud coming down the road, they might become curious enough to look at the actual data, and that may change their policy. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that would be the case.
Well, how are you coming with your particular organization, Stop the Mandates, or No Vaccine Mandates?
In what specifically are you asking?
Well, for example, how are you going to go forward? And now that your son's own personal situation is resolved, where does that leave you with this organization? Do you want to fight for other people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't actually, it's been some time that I even think of my son in this fight. I mean, to me, it's become much more about this horrible wrong that's being perpetrated on this group of American citizens and the representation of that as us losing all of our medical freedoms and people, you know, like boiling frogs, they just don't see it. So I feel like I have to do something, and this is what I've chosen to do, and I'm just going to keep at it because it's just so wrong and dangerous.
Do you worry about the country itself?
Oh, absolutely, every day.
Tell me the kinds of things that are troubling you.
It has become accepted for people to not expect to have freedom and individual choice and privacy and actual property rights. What happened in Canada when they, you know, took people's bank accounts, mm-hmm. didn't even raise an eyebrow to most people I knew. And so, yeah, I worry about that. I worry about the trillions of dollars they just dumped into the money supply and borrowed for COVID relief and what that's going to do to everyone. And I do worry very much about, I just worry that we're becoming a tyranny and that, you know, the great experiment of our republic is over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of us out here are thinking very hard about these things, and it's very troubling, but we're going to go forward, and we may enjoy a few victories in the months ahead.
I hope so.
I personally think that the whole scene is going to flip. We're going to reach an inflection point or a point of criticality where some of the obvious realities of this can no longer be denied by people who still have half a brain.
Are you talking specifically about the COVID situation or about everything?
I'm talking about the whole panorama of lunacy out there, of ideas that are preposterous, motives and intentions of people and groups that are dangerous. Mm-hmm. And I think the picture is going to change quite a bit, but there it may be attended by a certain amount of hardship. And I think that's going to be a big part of the picture going forward.
Like a convulsion.
Yeah, I think that it's a social, political, economic convulsion. Every bit as momentous as the French Revolution, really.
I think you could be very, very correct on that.
So we'll see about that. Joni McGarry, I want to thank you very much for telling me about your experiences with the COVID melodrama and the vaccination melodrama that comes with it. I wish you good luck with your organization.
Thank you.
And hope that we can stop all of this medical tyranny.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll check in down the line and see how things have worked out for you.
I really appreciate you having me on. It's been a privilege. Thank you so much.
What's the internet address for No Vaccine Mandates?
It's nocollegemandates.com. And that's nocollegemandates.com. And you can find me at LadySpalding11 on Twitter. And on our website, it'll lead you to our Telegram group and to other resources. And you can also put an email in through that, and we answer all of them.
And I will put all that information in the show notes.
Okay.
And we will ride again.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.